Hello, everyone, and welcome back to a Closer Look True Crime Podcast, or welcome if you are new. Today I will be talking about yet another missing persons case, the case of Johnny Gosch. There have been quite a few documentaries on this case, and it is very publicized, so you may have heard a little bit about it already. And one quick thing I wanted to mention before we talk about the family's backstory is that the report on the night of Johnny's disappearance is very wrong and not very detailed at all. So I will be mostly going off Johnny's mom's perspective because it's much more detailed and accurate. So without further ado, let's get right into today's episode. Johnny's mom, Noreen Gosch, was married to another man before marrying Johnny's father. Not only was her previous husband diagnosed with cancer, but their home was hit by a huge tornado around the same time, and Noreen literally found her two children face down in the gravel after the tornado, which I can't even imagine what that would be like. Then, only 2 weeks later, her husband died from his cancer. So this woman was truly tough as nails, and I have so much respect for her and her toughness, which I know that a lot of people in her situation don't want to hear, but truly she is so tough. Then, a little while later, she got remarried to a man named John Gosch, and they had their first child together, Johnny. So Johnny grew up with his mom and dad, as well as his siblings from his mom's previous marriage. According to Noreen, the whole story started on September 3rd, 1982. However, official reports skip over this part entirely, which will seem a little suspicious once you hear about it. The Gosch family was at a high school football game that one of Noreen's older boys was playing in. Johnny and his parents were sitting in the bleachers, and a little while into the game, Johnny decided that he wanted some popcorn from the concession. Noreen and John said yes and sent him off to the concession with some money. Quite a bit of time passed and Johnny hadn't returned, so John, his father, went looking for him. John ended up finding him near the concession stand talking to a police officer, like he was very deep in conversation, which immediately John thought was a little odd. To this day, nobody knows what they were talking about or how the conversation even started, just that they were talking. So when John saw him, he just asked if Johnny could stand by the fence of the field so that he and Noreen could see him from the bleachers. Johnny ended his conversation with this police officer, and John went back up to the bleachers to meet Noreen. Every few minutes, either John or Noreen would look over at Johnny just to make sure that he was still there, until one time when they looked back, he was nowhere to be found. John went to go find him, again, and found Johnny speaking with the same police officer, except this time he was under the bleachers in the dark, which is really creepy and weird. John decided that it would be better to have Johnny just come sit with them in the bleachers for the last, 20 minutes of the game, so he wouldn't wander off because the game was almost over, it didn't really matter anyways. When the game was over, the Gosches and a few other families were walking out when Johnny spotted the police officer he had been talking to and said, "That man is really nice. I want to be a police officer when I grew up." Noreen said that she thought this whole interaction was very weird, and she thought that the police officer was a little odd for continuing to seek out one specific kid to make conversation with. I mean, Johnny wasn't that old, and she just thought it was really weird. So the next day, September 4th, 1982, it was a normal Saturday. Johnny went to the movies with a friend, and that evening they had a big dinner because Johnny's sister was visiting from college with her boyfriend, and his older brother was also home from college. They had a really nice time and everyone had a lot of fun. Johnny got ready for bed and before going up to sleep, he asked his parents if he would be able to do his paper route by himself the next morning instead of going with his father like usual. At the time, delivering papers was a very common job and most kids actually did it by themselves, but John would always go with Johnny because he was younger and they wanted to make sure he was safe. I do not know what happened to papers. I think they stopped. I know that some people get delivered papers, but it's not nearly as common, and I think that the internet kind of took that away because you can just read the news online now, but I'm not really sure. That's kind of interesting to think about. John initially said yes to Johnny going by himself, but Noreen didn't really feel comfortable with it yet, so Johnny went up to bed and was planning on doing the paper route with his father the next morning like usual. Strangely enough, a few minutes later, he came back downstairs to talk to Noreen. He gave her a hug and said, "Mom, I will always love you. You're the best." Then he smiled and went back upstairs to bed. To me, this kind of comes across as a kid trying to get their parents to say yes to something by treating them really nice. Maybe he wanted to go by himself. I don't know why he wanted to go by himself, but you never know. Then at 1:30 a.m., a call came into the household landline, which I thought was a little interesting. John answered the call and said, yes, all right, okay, and then hung up. Noreen asked who it was, and he said it was a wrong number. She didn't think much of it and went back to bed. But one thing she did say is that they had been getting calls like this almost every early morning on Sunday for a few weeks, which could just be a coincidence, but it could also be something else. The next morning, Noreen woke up to tons of calls on the landline from people wondering where their Sunday morning papers were. She figured Johnny had slept in or something, but he wasn't in his room, and his wagon, as well as their dog, was gone. And the dog was gone because Johnny always tied the dog to the wagon when he went on his paper routes. Noreen figured that him and John had just gone out late, and that's why people hadn't received their papers, but she got downstairs and realized that John was still home. Both John and Noreen thought it was very odd that he had already left, because he always woke up John before leaving. The couple also thought it was really out of the blue that he'd wanted to go by himself so bad that morning. They figured that he had just decided to go by himself without telling them, didn't want to go by what they said, and that he was just running late, so John went out to help him finish the route while Noreen started making breakfast. About 15 minutes later, John came back in a complete panic, yelling, "Johnny's missing, I can't find him, he's gone, something happened to him." The couple were immediately very panicked and went looking for him around the neighborhood. They found his wagon 2 blocks from their house, filled with newspapers still, and the dog was tied to it, but no Johnny. While everyone was still calling about their missing newspapers, Noreen and John called the police to report Johnny missing. John finished delivering the paper so people would stop calling while Noreen waited for the police to arrive. The Goshes only lived 10 blocks from the police station, yet it took over 40 minutes for them to arrive, and this was only the start of the terrible police work that was to come. In the meantime, Noreen had called a bunch of people, including all the newspaper boys, to see if anyone had seen Johnny. There were multiple paper boys for that area, and a few had seen Johnny that morning. One neighbor heard the sound of a wagon around 5:45 a.m., which leads us to believe that is when he left the house. Another paper boy named Mike was picking up his morning papers when he said that he saw a blue car stop in front of Johnny and back up to where he was standing. Apparently the driver looked like he was asking Johnny for directions, but he didn't respond and kept walking. Soon after, an attorney named John Rossi approached them to pick up newspapers for his kids to deliver, and he talked to the driver as well.
I was there that morning. Johnny was doing his wagon. Johnny's dog was there with him. There were two or three other carriers there doing the same. I was the only adult, though. There happened to be a car on 42nd Street, and there was a guy in there, and he was talking to Johnny Gosh. Johnny said, "Hey, can you come over here and help this guy?" This car just swerved. He made a U-turn, took off. I thought it was kind of strange that he would do that.
Johnny said that he felt really weird and had this weird gut feeling about the conversation with this man, and he even said, "I'm scared, I'm going home," and started to walk away. Basically, as soon as Johnny started walking away, the person in the blue car backed up and drove away. The attorney also left around this time, and Mike, as well as a few other paper boys, remember seeing the man in the car flash his lights 3 times as he drove away. And as this man flashed his lights in the car, another man came out from between 2 random houses and started following Johnny down the road. They both disappeared around a corner, but the boys say that they could hear Johnny's dog growling from around the corner. Then 2 more newspaper carriers reported seeing Johnny slumped over in his wagon, but for some reason they just kept walking. Another neighbor also heard a car door slam, went to his window to see who it was, and saw a silver and black Ford Fairmont roll through a stop sign and turn left to where Johnny was walking. Now, just a warning, this might be the worst case when it comes to police work that I've ever heard of, so the investigation portion of this will be a little frustrating to listen to for most people, but it's still very important to mention, obviously. Back when this took place, there was also a law that police couldn't start a search and an investigation into a missing person for 48 or 72 hours, depending on the area, so they told Noreen and John that they would start the investigation in a few days. This law was honestly one of the most dumb things ever, because as you may know, the first 24 hours are so important in all missing persons cases, but especially missing children. So by waiting 2 or 3 days, you're missing the most critical investigation time of the case, and probably if you miss that one day, you could miss your opportunity in finding the kid. In the meantime, Noreen had collected all of these witness statements from other paper boys and neighbors when the police had done absolutely nothing. The day of his disappearance, Noreen and John didn't even hear from the police at all for basically the entire day until 8:30 when they came to get a few pictures of Johnny for the case. They didn't even bring them to the station for questioning, talk to witnesses at the station, or search the area at all. Another frustrating thing is that the investigators in charge didn't take the Goshes seriously at all. They completely disregarded all the witnesses that Noreen had told them she'd collected and were convinced that he just ran away, even though Noreen and John said that he would never do this and he was not that kind of kid. Noreen thought it was also really weird that they didn't want to ask any questions to her and John when they were over collecting pictures, so she called the parents of the witnesses and asked if the police had spoken to them or their kids. They said that the police came over to talk, but didn't even bring a pen or a paper or anything to record the conversation with, so there was no record that that conversation even happened. Another suspicious thing is that the police chief, Orville Cooney, said that the Goshes should just stay home, not talk to any media, and basically keep Johnny's disappearance a secret and stop doing any campaigning that they were already doing. He even said that the Gosh family shouldn't attend searches or help in any way, which I think is very, very, very weird. Thankfully, the community really supported Noreen and John throughout all this. They organized their own searches and basically did the investigators' work for them. And funny enough, on one of their own searches, a drunk police officer came up to them and was getting all mad because they were doing their own searches outside of the police's investigation, which is very, very odd because people do their own searches all the time and there never seems to be a problem with that. Noreen was very action-oriented and determined to find Johnny, so she went against what police were telling her and ended up doing a TV interview. She basically used this airtime to plea to whoever had Johnny to do the right thing and send him home.
Johnny, we love you. We're waiting for you to come home. We're doing everything in our power to get you back. And we're leaving the porch light on every night. Moms are like that.
A lot of people took this the wrong way, though, and thought that she wasn't broken enough for what she was going through. Noreen also had to become very pushy when it came to Johnny's case, because it's very frustrating to see a lead come in and nothing to happen. I would definitely be pushy, too. She had to push and do things herself, or else the case wouldn't have progressed at all. I think that she was able to be so strong also, because after everything she'd been through, she had no other choice but to learn to be tough and keep pushing, and I feel like the way that she handled it was almost the best way that she could. And people were so awful to the family after Noreen began talking to the media and would even have the guts to drive by their house and yell, "I hope your son is dead." How can you even do that to a person? One of Noreen's other goals, I guess you could say, was to help other parents in her situation and prevent it from happening to other people. She decided to team up with a few parents of missing children to form the National Center for Exploited and Missing Children. Noreen also implemented the Johnny Gosh Bill, which required law enforcement to act immediately in all missing persons cases, which was super impactful. That literally changed missing persons cases for everyone else, which was just so amazing. It made it so people had to get started right away. They couldn't wait the 2 days, the 3 days, the whatever. They had to get started right away. Months went by without any developments in the case until August 19th, 1984, when another paperboy around the same age as Johnny disappeared. It was even in the same area of Iowa, so Noreen started thinking that the two cases could be connected. And his name was Eugene Martin. Eugene's parents felt very much the same as Johnny's parents when it came to the police work that they were dealing with, and they were feeling very helpless.
You just feel completely lost. You know, you don't know what to do, where to go, who to talk to.
It's just like a movie being rerun, that we're watching the movie. except the actors are different.
Mr. Martin, did your son, Eugene, know about the Johnny Gosch case?
Yes, he's heard of it, and he's been aware of the story of Johnny Gosch and all.
Is it possible that the same person kidnapped both boys, or is that just a coincidence?
It's possible. At this point, they have not determined whether there is a link between the two cases yet, but there's a great many facts that are very striking.
Are you hopeful that the trail for Eugene Martin might lead to Johnny, too?
Yes, we are.
A milk company also decided to put Eugene and Johnny's pictures on their cartons, which is something I mentioned in the Eitan Patz case. It was something that a lot of milk companies did in the 80s and 90s to spread awareness for missing children's cases, and I think that it was really great. Then in 1986, another paperboy named Mark Allen went missing in a similar area as Johnny and Eugene. And unfortunately, his disappearance was treated with similar neglect and was never solved, just like Eugene and Johnny's. An official connection was never made between the three cases, which is honestly not surprising considering the lack of effort in all three of these cases, and all three remain unsolved to this day. Thankfully, about a year after Eugene went missing, there was a little bit of a break in Johnny's case. Someone received a dollar bill at a grocery store as change that had "I'm alive, Johnny Gosch" written on it. We cannot confirm that this was Johnny who wrote it, because anyone could have just wrote it. It could have been just some sick joke, but I honestly really hope that it was Johnny.
A lady called us one night about 9 o'clock at night, said that she had received this bill and change at a grocery store in Sioux City, Iowa. And I asked her, would you please send us the bill? I'll send you a dollar back for it. That's what she did.
Then in 1998, the Goshes received a letter directly to them that they believed was from Johnny. It was a typed letter that was postmarked from Idaho. The writer claimed that they were Johnny and that he had been kidnapped and forced to do terrible things. He said his kidnappers dyed his hair and gave him a new name. And at the end of the letter, he signed it, "Your son, Johnny." I really hope, once again, that this wasn't just some cruel person that thought that they were being hilarious, because that would just be horrible. And I really hope that it was Johnny, because that would mean that he was still alive at this point, which would be great. Then the biggest break in the case happened in 1991. A man named Paul Benassi came forward and confessed to being in the car that took Johnny and said that he was a part of his abduction. Paul was a registered sex offender with a very troubling past, and he was involved in a very terrible crime called the Franklin cover-up, which I definitely think you should look into yourself, but I could not put it in this episode because it's like an entire episode in itself. And he was currently in jail for this crime. He also had been in and out of jail many times before this for various different things. Paul was also exposed to sexual exploitation and was in a child prostitution ring from a very young age, which really messed him up and left him with dissociative identity disorder, which I also recommend looking deeper into on your own, because if I got into that, this episode would be hours long, but it's very, very interesting. To give you a simple rundown, though, your personality is kind of like a bus. Just stay with me here. Normally, a person has one personality, or in this metaphor, one driver, and this person or driver is consistently in control of driving the bus or in control of your personality. And except when you have DID, there are passengers or different personalities on the bus that sometimes take control and drive the bus, and this is the person that you see from the outside. So this person has like many different personalities that rotate through, and it's like, it's very, very interesting. And DID is usually caused by trauma in the early years of life when your personality is still developing. Because of this trauma, this person can't form one uniform personality, and so they get a bunch of different ones that are kind of all broken up, and they're completely different people inside of them. I'm not really sure if that makes sense, but I hope it does.
It is only through these personalities that he remembers the day he helped kidnap Johnny Gosch.
Every time he would put his head down and call up somebody, it seemed authentic. It seemed to me that he couldn't fake that. This guy probably wasn't capable of coming up with all these voices and all these different things to say.
Benassi can call forth his alter egos at will. First to emerge, Mark Anderson, 15 years old.
All I remember him talking about was that this was the boy that they were gonna take.
Paul says a Des Moines accomplice snuck up from behind as the abduction was made. Benassi did his part, chloroforming Johnny.
I held him down for a second. I put this thing that Emilio told me to over his face, and a few seconds later, he went out.
There is a possibility that Paul could be making this up, and I understand where people are coming from when they think that his story isn't very credible, but why would you make this up? He didn't benefit from it in any way, his jail time didn't go down, and it honestly made his life harder because he had to undergo a bunch of rounds of interrogation and questioning because he was a witness to this abduction. He also remembered very intricate details about Johnny that someone who hadn't seen him up close wouldn't have known, such as a burn that he currently had on his tongue, a scar on one of his legs. And initially, Noreen was understandably very upset and angry at him for possibly being involved in her son's kidnapping, but she says she also felt bad because she understood that he was forced into this and felt super guilty about it and was doing the right thing by coming forward. After Noreen had a little bit of time to think, she decided that she would meet Paul in the prison.
Mrs. Cash wanted to talk to you.
Just tell me what happened. Please.
I felt so bad about it because what they made me do.
Benassi drew a map of the clan, a replica of one drawn by the kidnappers. Noreen Gosh says this X marks the exact spot of the abduction.
Basically, what Paul said is that there was a man named Emilio who was part of this giant pedophilia ring. He said that it was premeditated and they found Johnny, gagged him, and drove away. Then, in 2003, the FBI busted Emilio's whole pedophilia ring and they were able to rescue 105 kids from the sex trafficking trade, but not Johnny. Then, shortly after this, America's Most Wanted decided to cover Johnny's case. They interviewed Paul Benassi on the show, and he ended up taking them to this house in the middle of nowhere. It was in a very unpopulated part of Colorado, and he said that this house is where all the children were kept. There was this huge underground dugout area with boys' initials scratched into the wood beams, but police never looked into this, which I think is absolutely absurd. Why wouldn't you look into this? Because they could have possibly saved more kids from the sex trafficking trade. So from what I told you, you can probably tell that the police force was super corrupt in this area. And when I'm telling you about the suspicious police work, don't forget Johnny's weird experience with that cop at the game only 2 days before he disappeared. I think it's definitely possible that this interaction with the cop could have been linked to Johnny's disappearance, and that there's some sort of cover-up going on behind the scenes. At this time, the police force was also really starting to fall apart. The chief of police had recently gotten in trouble for beating someone up at a bar, and numerous officers also had other charges against them that they should have been fired for, but of course, they weren't. There was also a lot of politics going on behind the scenes, but I'm not going to get into that today because this episode, once again, would be far too long. Every piece of evidence that ever came forward was dismissed and never properly looked into, which I find so incredibly odd. And as I mentioned, America's Most Wanted covered Johnny's case, and after asking numerous times, the FBI finally agreed to do a TV interview with them, but literally nothing came out of it, and here's why.
Are you familiar with the Johnny Gosch case? He was an Iowa paperboy who disappeared 30 years ago.
I am not personally familiar with that case.
But do you know about it?
We agreed that we were not talk about the Johnny Gosch case at all.
Oh, okay. I'm sorry. I didn't know
there
that.
There would be no questions about that.
Then in 1997, one of the most crazy things happened in Johnny's case. Noreen claims that Johnny came to her house to visit them.
There was a knock on my door, a persistent knocking. And I went to the door and I could see a young man standing out there. And I kept looking at his eyes. And the eyes don't change. And so I said, "Who is it?" And he said, "It's me, Mom. Johnny."
Another young man with him, and Johnny did not introduce him. I said, "Let me call somebody to help." He immediately got very upset and he said, "They'll kill me if they know I've been here." He shared some information about how they trafficked the kids through the country and that the kids were forced to do a lot of things that were illegal. So therefore, none of them would ever go to the police for help. And then in a very short time, it was over and he said, "I have to go."
For years, Noreen kept this to herself because she didn't think that people were going to believe her, and the only reason that anyone ever found out about this was because she was in court under oath and they asked if she had seen Johnny since she disappeared, and she said yes. Then, quite a few years later, in August of 2006, Noreen received a bunch of photos of boys that were bound and gagged. She was quite upset about this, obviously, but noticed that a few of the pictures looked like they were Johnny, which I can't even imagine what that would be like. At this point, he had been gone 35 years, but the family still had hope that he could be alive, and they still have hope to this day. As you can imagine, this case has a whole lot of theories, and most of them aren't really worth getting into in today's episode because there's quite a few crazy theories, but I have a few that I will be discussing that I think are particularly interesting or convincing. The first theory is that Johnny is still alive and he is Jeff Gannon. I know this sounds crazy, but let me explain. Jeff Gannon was a press guy for the White House during the Bush administration, and before working at the White House, literally nobody had ever heard of him. He had no prior experience in journalism, and he kind of just appeared one day and got the job. Not only does Jeff look a lot like Johnny, but funny enough, they also have the same initials, JG. Jeff has been very, very secretive about his past and said that he would take a DNA test, but it isn't worth it because he's not Johnny, which seems a little suspicious. And I don't really know what to think about this. I mean, it could be real, but he could also just be someone who doesn't want to reveal their past. Maybe he has, like, something to hide that's not anything to do with Johnny's case. You never really know. There's also the theory that Johnny is still in sex trafficking, which I really, really hope not. That would not be good. Or that he got out and is living under a different name, or that he's hiding out in the mountains or something. But either way, I don't think that anyone knows whether he's alive or not, or where he is, because I don't think that he would be known as Johnny Gosch. I don't think that he would still be under that identity. Branching off on that, what I feel like we need to talk about is why Johnny can't just be himself, why he can't come home, why he can't come live with his parents again, and why would he be living under this other identity? And I do believe that he definitely could be alive and is just living under a different identity, whether it's Jeff Gannon or someone completely different. But lots of people don't think that he is alive, because why wouldn't he just come home if he saw what his family was going through? But you have to understand that he was believed to be involved in a very illegal thing, run by very dangerous people that probably threatened that if they ever told anyone what happened in this situation, that they would be killed or something like that. And so if he went home to his family, he could be possibly putting himself or them in danger. And when he went home, and if he was like, oh, well, I'm alive, I'm home, there would be far too many questions that they would want to know everything, what happened. They would, press would be everywhere, investigations would be happening and everything like that. And if he can't talk about what happened because of a threat that's been made against him, then he can't really come home because there would just be far too many questions, which I think is super unfortunate. But I definitely believe that he could be alive somewhere. So thank you all so much for listening to today's episode. I hope you enjoyed it as much as I enjoyed creating it for you all. Make sure you check out my Instagram, which is linked in the description. I post little sneak peeks. I post behind the scenes, open case requests, everything like that. And I hope to see you next Monday for another episode of A Closer Look True Crime Podcast.